Greetings and welcome to MERS Monday, the official podcast of the MERS Political Newsletter. I'm Kyle Malin, joined by Jack Spencer and Mike Malott. A little later, Stu Sandler from Grand River Strategies will be joining us to talk about politics and the changing face of politics and running in 2018. But first, guys, on Sunday night, we had campaign finance reports on the congressional side. It's funny how these things come out on the 15th, come a hell or high water. And if it's on a Sunday, well, by God, it just happens to be on a Sunday. And that's just the way it is. It's not like tax day that they move it to the next Monday or whatever. So I was up until 1 o'clock this morning, guys, taking a look at these numbers. And Alyssa Slotkin, Jack, this is pretty amazing. She has outraised everybody. Fred Upton, her opponent that she's going to be presumably facing in November, Mike Bishop. Alyssa Slotkin's raised $1.15 million for the cycle, $2.8 million overall, and she has $2.2 million in cash on hand, which is more than her opponent, Mike Bishop, presumably in November, more than anybody. What do you make of that?
Well, I think we knew at the very beginning she had very good connections coming here from the D.C. area. But you also have to watch what she's done since she's been running. And it's like she's very impressive, and she really hasn't made any mistakes. And she's groomed herself, it seems to me, very well for the position. It's very interesting, her comments on, oh, if Mike Rogers was running, then I wouldn't be in here. I mean, you stop and think about, well, they voted for Rogers all those years. That's kind of a good thing to say in terms of being not super far left or progressive. And those are just some pretty smart things to do. So I would say that in the Mike Bishop camp, they're looking and they know they're in for a big fight.
How interesting is this, Mike? You've covered the 8th Congressional District for several years. To see Alyssa Slotkin, a Democrat, outraising anybody else in the state, that's got to be pretty striking.
It really is. That district has been, I thought, safe Republican for a long, long time. I mean, Mike Rogers held it and was never really challenged. For a Democrat to come into that district and perform well is really surprising. But I think that shows the potential for the blue wave, which, you know, I guess we're going to see. Democrats have a real habit of not showing up to the polls. They got to change that this time around if they want to have their blue wave, but maybe they're motivated, and this would be a sign.
Well, and let's take a look at some other signs of this blue wave that we've talked about before. Ellen Kogan Lipton, a candidate running in the 9th Congressional District, raised $540,000. Again, more than Bill Huizenga or Tim Walberg or, you know, and incumbents who you would think would raise a lot of money, more than John Molinar or the 1st Congressional District incumbent, Jack Bergman. She raised more than that. Gretchen Driscoll raised $400,000. Sunil Gupta raised $400,000. Andy Levin, $353,000. Rashida Tlaib, $300,000. I mean, the only people who are raising more on the Republican side, Jack, are incumbents who have connections to D.C. There's a lot of Democrats here who are raising a good amount of money. Fairuz Saad. I mean, who's Fairuz Saad in the 11th Congressional District raising a good amount of money?
Well, I think the Democrats, at least at the donor level this year, are more than happy to open their wallets and make these investments, or however you want to look at it, in any race that looks like something that, you know, if they can be convinced that they have a real shot of taking it. The Democrats are clearly willing, you know, and again, I'm guessing a lot of this money is perhaps coming from outside of Michigan, but they're obviously very much in tune to the idea that we've got to really, you know, win the battle of the dollars if we're going to have any kind of chance anywhere. On the other hand, Republicans, I always caution about these things because they can be a little more tight-fisted at first, and let's see who's going to do what, et cetera, before we invest our money. When it's a few districts, you have to figure sooner or later the Republican side is probably going to equalize to some extent before the thing's over. That's the thing. But right now it's very impressive that the Democrats can get this much money and can get it so quickly, and it's one less thing they have to worry as much about later.
Mike, let's just take a look at the 11th Congressional District. That's easily the most competitive district in the state, with a combined 10 candidates, Republicans and Democrats, going for this. The Democrats are fundraising much better. You know, Sunil Gupta, we've already talked about, Tim Grimmel, Haley Stevens, Feroz Saad, all of whom in the last period raised over $100,000 and overall have raised at least $600,000. Now, Nancy Skinner hasn't reported yet, so, you know, we didn't include her among those four. But at the cash on hand level, all of them have significant resources, and all of them have more money than any of the Republican candidates, with the exception of Lena Epstein, who's self-financing.
And you have to keep in mind that you have well-known people on the Republican side. Mike Colwell, Rocky Rajkowski, Kerry Bentivoglio, Clint Kestow. These people have been around, and Dems are outperforming them. That's very surprising.
Let's also take a look at the other open seat. Rashida Tlaib is a huge fundraising advantage over her opponents. For the cycle, she's raised almost $1 million, and really nobody else has come close here, Mike. Bill Wild is almost at $400,000, but Brenda Jones is still doing all right, $128,000. Ian Conyers is kind of in the same ballpark. Coleman Young's reporting a debt. I don't know how that works, but he reported a negative cash on hand balance, which I didn't think you were allowed to do, but what have you. But Rashida Tlaib, she may end up being the front runner in all this. Jack, who would have thunk it? This is once again showing the power of mobilization and getting into this market of folks on the coast, California, Massachusetts, New York, these deep-pocketed liberal donors who don't really have anything in their districts to put their money toward are playing in these districts across the country. And, you know, if you've got $1 million and you can put $1,000 here, you can give $1,000 to Tlaib, you can give $1,000 to Ellen Kogan Lipton, that's what you're going to do.
Well, don't forget, I mean, it was literally a shockwave when this blue state went red 2 years ago, or a year and a half ago. And I think that there's a lot more awareness that, holy cow, we better start looking at some of these places we've been taking for granted in the last decade or so. So I think they're willing to put their money down on the possibility, obviously, of somebody being able to pull something off or pull upsets off or, you know, hang on to districts. I just think that that's what it's showing right now, is the Dem side, as far as national donors is concerned, are more than willing to go ahead and make their investments early.
One last thing before we change subjects here, just to show you how well Democrats are doing, Matt Morgan in the 1st District, who isn't even on the ballot, is staying competitive with the incumbent Jack Bergman in the 1st District. He's raised for the cycle $743,000, which isn't too far off Jack Bergman's $978,000. Now, Jack, you saw an interesting internet ad that we were not aware of with Gretchen Whitmer. What did you see?
Yes, it's about the quickest, shortest ad you'd ever can imagine seeing on YouTube. And it starts out basically somebody getting in a car. You don't see their face or anything. You're just looking sort of in the cockpit of the car. And they set their coffee down and they start to drive the car. And then boom, bang, obviously they hit a pothole or something like that. The coffee spills and the person goes like this, and then immediately after that you see the Gretchen Whitmer name come up there and fix the damn roads. And this thing is so, when I first saw it, it was so brief, I thought, is anybody even going to catch that? But on the YouTube, I can't remember what show I was watching on YouTube, but it came up a good three more times during that hour and a half show. So obviously, if you hit that over and over again, you're connecting Whitmer's name with fix the damn roads. And I thought it was quite an innovative idea.
That is a pretty cool ad. I hadn't seen that yet, but you probably watch a little more YouTube than me.
I think it was WKRP in Cincinnati from the 70s I was watching.
You keep watching that one same show over and over again when they throw the frozen turkeys out of the helicopter.
No, it's not the turkey one. I like the one where they take the drunk test on the air. That's my favorite.
One other thing I wanted to address, Mike. the minimum wage ballot proposal. They're taking a different tact on this legally. Explain to our listeners who might not have seen the story what the business community is trying to do to knock this off the ballot.
Well, they've challenged it in the Court of Appeals on the grounds it's really an amendment of the existing law. It's been written as an entirely new law. But the interesting part about it is there's an exhibit in it that shows what the difference in the wording is between the existing law and the new law. And the Restaurant Association spokesperson had it right when he says that it's 99% the old law. There's very little change. It's about three lines. It's not very much. So I think they have a point in challenging it, saying that it's really not a new law. It's an amendment of the old law.
So, Jack, we know why they did it this way, don't we?
Well, of course we do. Before, with the minimum wage, if you recall what the way they knocked that thing down.
The Republicans knocked this
down. The Republicans and the legislature is they got rid of the old law. And then they did a new law, and then they said, look, what laws has been referenced in this ballot proposal no longer exists.
So we killed it.
So they killed it. So this is, you can very much understand why the backers of this ballot proposal, why they wanted to do it in the way they did it, and why they wanted to not say we're just amending things or just, because the minute you do that, they've seen the trick that the Republicans can play.
So if this ballot proposal succeeds, there's no incentive to do any ballot proposals, really, because you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You're damned if you try and amend the law, because the legislature can come and just eliminate the law altogether and then create a different law, and so all your efforts had been for naught. Or you can go ahead and just try and pass your own law, and then you'd have the court say, well, that's too similar to one that already exists. So
if the court attempt to knock it off the ballot succeeds, then, it really doesn't leave whoever wants to do a ballot proposal with very many options,
right,
in terms of actually being able to prevent the legislature from using this trick to prevent it from going before the voters. I really will be surprised if the court buys into this argument. To some extent, any change in the law, you could say, is amending the law instead of changing it. I think it's kind of dicey.
We also have another group that's challenging the voters, not politicians, ballot proposal. Their argument is essentially you're doing too many changes. So we've got something in the court saying you're making too many changes, this ballot proposal shouldn't go in. And now you've got another one saying you're making too few changes, so this shouldn't go in.
You wonder, though, at what point the court's going to start saying, hey, you're almost creating an impossible situation for anybody to even put something on the ballot. And it's technical. Is it really fooling the voters at all that you didn't list a bunch of technical things on there that they couldn't care less about?
Is this an act of desperation on the part of the restaurant community and the business community trying to knock this minimum wage thing off the ballot?
Well, it's easy for me to say yes, it's an act of desperation, but I don't have to come up with however millions of dollars it's going to take to try to knock it down if it gets on the ballot. So obviously you take every step you can and you take a shot at it.
The minimum wage ballot proposal, if it were to make the ballot, it's not unbeatable, is it?
I think there's a lot of things that aren't unbeatable once you accept the fact that we've got to try to beat it. And I do wonder sometimes when you're spending so much effort and so much time trying to prevent it from getting on the ballot, I would just think that they would have somebody in some back room somewhere already coming up with ideas what you're going to do and how you're going to fight it if it gets on. Because if you wait forever and then all of a sudden you have to panic and come up with a strategy for knocking it down, I would think that's not a very good way of going at it.
I think the people who wanted to preserve the prevailing wage can attest to that, Jack. They put all their eggs into the court basket, and then when it came down to the legislative action, it went to pots, and now we have the prevailing wage repealed.
But you do wonder, how many times can you keep things off the ballot, keep things from going before the voters, until sooner or later you're going to actually have to face it and come up with a strategy where you actually face the voters and make the argument? And it's all delay, 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 hooker. We're trying this kind of trick, we're trying that kind of trick to keep it off the ballot, but, inevitably, sooner or later, somebody's going to have to actually test this stuff in front of the voters.
How many times did we have wolf hunting supposedly on the ballot, right?
Well, yeah. And it, you can use the cried wolf joke to go along with it and stuff like that. Stuff like that, too. But, yeah, there are some. But you do have to start wondering at some point, how many times has it become a game where, okay, we figured out some trick again to stop them. We figure out some trick again to stop them. But sooner or later, you know, push comes to shove, it's going to go the other side's going to find a way to get in front of the voters.
All right. Well, with that, we're going to bring in Stu Sandler to talk about elections. All right, joining us now in MERS World Headquarters is our old friend Stu Sandler with Grand River Strategies. Thanks for joining us, Stu.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. Now, I was trying to think, the first campaign you ever did, do you remember the first campaign you worked on?
First campaign I worked on was John Shaw in 1994. He was I was still in University of Michigan, and he was running against Lynn Rivers.
Oh, God, that must have been a uphill battle, to say the least.
It was. You know, John actually was making more of a race of it than normal because it was the 1994, the year Gingrich kind of had the contract with America. And I was naive and young and thought maybe there's a difference. But he was probably one of the few races that actually lost that night. So me and my friends who were in it were very upset at the prospects that we couldn't turn Ann Arbor red.
If anybody could turn Ann Arbor red, you guys would be canonized within the Republican Party. That seems like an impossibility.
I can't say I had much responsibility in there, maybe lit dropping a couple of precincts, but still was a fun race.
Yeah, I'm sure. Well, for our listeners' benefit, you are with the PAC that is supporting Bill Schuette and opposing Brian Kelly, and your role with John James.
Yes.
Just remind our listeners
sure.
what that is.
So I'm the executive director of Better Jobs, Stronger Families, the PAC that is supporting Bill Schuette. I am also the senior advisor for John James for Senate.
And you're still with Grand River Strategies. Any other races that you're doing in that role? Bishop or
Mike Bishop, I'm his general consultant. I'm working with Paul Mitchell. I'm also the general consultant for the House Republican Campaign Committee.
Okay, so you're doing that work. I wanted to bring you in here to talk about how you're seeing this campaign going through the lens of a political operative. How have things changed, and how are things different in 2018 than in prior races? Is there something that's really striking to you?
One thing is I think the pace of the messaging because of social media, because of the internet. You don't really have news cycles anymore. I mean, you have things breaking at 10 o'clock on Friday night and, you know, 2 o'clock on a Monday morning. I mean, just things break at just all sorts of hours. You also have less political journalists out there. A lot of the bureaus just don't have the manpower that they used to have, and the breakneck information that's coming, you have less time for people to cover things. So those are two things I think you see right away.
Well, let's talk about the news aspect of that. Why is that a problem? Folks might be like, so what? So there's two political journalists around.
Well, I think the problem with that is it's hard to take topics that are very complicated and distill them in an objective way by journalists. So a lot of times what you'll see is you'll see campaigns or entities kind of throw out things that just, and frankly, some people just pick it up because they'll see whatever news source it has as fact. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's hard to break down. And then, you know, there's also, I think, more personal opinions that have been seeping into news. One of the things about social media is there are journalists who actually, you see their personal opinions seep out in their posts on social media. So then you just as a reader, it's hard to say, well, how does that not affect their news?
Yeah, that's a good point. We never had anything like that before. There used to be a very black line on that, you know, your news or your opinion, and never the two shall meet. And it seems like we are getting more into that. And to your point, too, the newsrooms are getting smaller. I mean, it's something that we've noticed on this program all the time. The Associated Press, for one, has gone from 4 to 1 reporter. Mm-hmm. The Detroit Free Press used to have 2 folks up here all the time. The Lansing State Journal used to have 2 people here all the time. You know, the news, obviously, they've been shrinking to a certain extent. There's only 1 or 2 TV journalists up here. From our standpoint, it can be very difficult to write stories and really dig down into various subjects.
No, you totally see it. And you see it, you know, I feel it when I'm on the phone with reporters. I could feel their deadlines coming up. And, you know, all of them, for the most part, I work with a very professional and try to do the best job they can. But there's so much information flying at them and their deadlines are so tight that, you know, they're doing the best they can.
So in the absence of that, what we have are folks are almost taking it upon themselves, going to Facebook, going to Twitter. And you see these websites like, let's say, Medium, for example. Mm-hmm. Which basically just takes press releases and puts them on there. And then folks grab that on, let's say, Facebook and take a Medium article and look and present this as like news and say, look, this is what's going on, when really it's just a press release.
Yeah, I come across voters all the time that will say to me, I don't know where this came from, but, and they'll lay out a premise that's really another candidate's ad. And they won't, it won't be cited, it won't be, and some of it will be just pure fabrication. But there's this idea of if it's on the internet and it's in a channel, then that's one of the things Facebook's cracking down on, is the fact that this, you know, fake news sites, fake news is a very real thing.
We've got the gubernatorial race, we've got U.S. Senate race, and we've got congressional races. And we've always had these races, but it seems like these races have gotten maybe more sophisticated. Folks who are running for state senate or state house have been a bit more sophisticated. Maybe there's more attention to them, too, because of Facebook or social media. Is that a fair analysis?
Yeah, I think it's a fair analysis. You know, I mean, campaign cycles are getting longer. There is more professionalism, and frankly, there's less institutions for a lot of these candidates that they can go. They can distribute information on Facebook. They can distribute information through the, you know, digital ads, which are really cheap, really efficient. I mean, in, you know, legislative races, sort of mail is still king, but there still are a lot of ways to get their message out in efficient, cheap ways.
Talk about the role of TV. Are we seeing more of it, less of it, and is it more or less effective than it ever has been?
I think you're seeing a little less of it, and that digital and social media has taken up some of that. But it's still the most effective way to get a broad message out. You know, by far, on the statewide campaigns, you'll see the, you know, the massive percentages of spent on TV versus everything else. It just, there's no better way to disseminate your message to a broader audience than through broadcast and cable television.
So if you're doing broadcast, and you would rather do broadcast than cable, right?
Broadcast has a bigger reach. I mean, some cable, and, you know, take a Fox News, which is an efficient way of getting the Republican primary voters, but broadcast will have a larger reach.
There have always been these candidates targeting special programs. You mentioned Fox News, but I listen to a lot of radio, a lot of AM radio, WJR, 1320 here in Lansing, the Michael Patrick Shields show, Steve Gruber. And it seems like I'm hearing more conservative radio ads during those times.
People advertise what demographics tell them to. There are a lot of conservatives that listen to talk radio, particularly conservative radio shows. The old, you know, the audience for talk radio is older, which means it bends more towards conservative Republicans. So yeah, you're hearing those ads are not just, you know, coincidental. There's a reason why people are trying to target those audiences. There are people who are interested in news, interested in politics, and more likely to vote than audiences that listen to entertainment or other sorts of radio.
The other thing I wanted to mention, Mark Grubner was in here last week, and he had mentioned how more people are voting absentee. How has that changed campaigning?
Well, it's definitely been a higher increase in absentee voters. One, you know, the population is getting naturally older. They're reaching older ages. And two, there's been more and more people who take advantage of absentee. The only interesting thing is how people hold their ballots. When it used to be people turn their ballots in right away. Now there's more people hold them. There's still a certain percentage that, you know, take it, vote, get out right away. People hold the ballots. They want to, you know, for legislative races, they want to meet the candidate. Oh. For statewide, they want to, you know, see what else is coming. So there is a lot less tendency to turn ballots in right away. There's still the population that does it. But, yeah, I mean, there is a higher degree of absentee voters.
And so how does that change from a campaign standpoint? Does that mean you just got to get stuff out earlier than usual? I mean, does that kind of perpetuate this expanded campaign cycle that we were talking about earlier?
Yeah, I mean, some of that's that. Some of that's how do we reach these absentee? You know, some of it, do we go through the mail because they're getting mail? Do we reach them in a broader audience on TV? Do we reach out more to them digitally? I mean, they're all sort of calculations you make. You're trying to get voters when they're voting.
Let's talk about polling. Polling has definitely changed because more people use cell phones. I mean, mm-hmm. How many people pick up their landline anymore? How has that presented a challenge in campaigning?
Because, you know, a large percent of the audience just has cell phones, which means they can only be reached by live polling. They can't be reached by automatic, like, individual voice recorded polling, which is the press one, press two. So you have to sort of find blends of that. And live polling is more expensive than IVR polling. Mm. And so in broader audiences, it's important to have cell populations in your polling for it to be accurate. IVRs can still be a good benchmark in terms of watching trends, particularly in Republican primaries, which happen to have older, wider audiences, which is more likely to have a landline than a cell phone. But it's still, you know, when you're watching statewide polls or any polls in general, you'd like to see cells because it includes important parts of demographics that you don't get otherwise. But it's more expensive, and that's why you're not seeing as many live polls. That's why you're not seeing, frankly, one of the things I've been surprised at this cycle is how few polls there have been for a lot of these statewide races. And part of it is the price of it.
Yeah.
People are less likely to answer their phone. They're less likely to go through the, you know, myriad of questions they get. And it's just harder and more expensive to find them.
Yeah, and I wonder how much of this, too, is folks who are just feel like they've been burned by polls in the past. And I'm talking from the media standpoint. Mm-hmm. They felt like, shoot, Hillary was supposed to win. She didn't win the primary. She didn't win the general in Michigan. And she was supposed to win both, according to the polls. And I wonder how much that plays into it as well.
That plays in a part of it, but I think that's why you've got these pollsters who are experts at what they do. And you really see that. I mean, there were pollsters, you know, I think there's been this wrong narrative. The polls got it wrong in 2016. I don't think that was the case. There were a lot of pollsters that they got it right, or they said there's this real pocket of voters that are undecided and that broke late. But, you know, I remember there were a lot of pollsters telling me, yeah, we see something coming. And, there were a lot of pollsters that got Michigan right, that got nationally right. There were just a good group of them that got it wrong.
Yeah. And you also got to remember the margin of error. And sometimes we think about that and we forget, you know, just because Hillary's up 3 or 4 points and the margin of error, it's still 5% in some of these polls. And just being within the margin of error, that's still not predicting anything. It's not like they said that Clinton was going to win 10 over Trump in the state of Michigan. So getting on the 2018 cycle, what has been the story of 2018 as far as the elections go?
I think in Republican primaries, I think Trump has had a massive footprint. I think if you look around the country, people who get endorsed by Trump largely win. People who did not support Trump in the 2016 election don't win. And I think you look all across the country in Republican primaries, that's largely played out.
Isn't that amazing? He was supposed to be a disaster.
I don't know by which, you know, means someone said, you know, I think the Republican Party, he got support early. He won all those early primaries. And he just sort of gained momentum as it went across. And I think for Republicans, you look at the economy, you look at some of his international wins, I think there are a lot of Republicans and independent voters that are satisfied with what he's doing.
Isn't that something else, though? I mean, to think that this guy who had been banged on so much in 2016, and now his endorsement is the single biggest thing you want if you're a Republican right now.
But I see, I think that's part of what makes him so influential is there are so many people and voters that think that no one has listened to me until Trump kind of came out and started speaking his economic populism. Mm-hmm. And I think there are a lot of people that think the system is pushing against Trump, which makes them more likely to support him. And that's where I think some of the power comes in. And I think some of it's in the accomplishment. You look at tax reform, you look at some of the wins he's done regulatory and in other places. And I think that's why people are saying, you know, I want other people to go help him with his agenda.
It's just so striking to watch the U.S. Senate race, which you're actively involved in right now, hear John James and Sandy Pensler argue over who's more pro-Trump. But that's really what it's boiled down to in some regard.
Yeah, I mean, a part of it. I mean, John James's bio is a big part of his story. In fact, he's a West Point graduate. The fact he served in Operation Iraqi Freedom. That's an element to John that's very popular. But also, yeah, I mean, there is an argument over Trump. You know, John just put up an ad which has, Sandy Pensler saying, you know, derogatory things about Trump behind closed doors. And it's his own voice saying it. And that's a powerful ad in a Republican primary.
Let's talk about one more thing I want to hit on before we talk about the governor's race is debates.
Sure.
Why is it that we're seeing fewer of them? And is there a strategy as far as managing candidates and the media as you get closer to an election?
Yeah, I think because of some of the ways you can cheap ways you could get your message out efficiently and not really have to go through conventional media, I think, is why a lot of candidates try to avoid debates. They want to be able to present the message on their own terms, and they don't want to have to, you know, deal with the media asking them questions. I mean, Sandy Penzler is a perfect example. John asked for quite a few debates. Penzler turned most of them down. Finally, when he felt boxed in, he conceded to the Skubic debate. But I think a lot of it is candidates like Penzler want to just put money on a screen and want to put their message out through paid media and not have to deal with anything else. You know, also in debates, I think, you know, you've talked about it and Skubic's talked about it. There's not a lot of debate forums which allow follow-up questions. I mean, that was one of the things about that Senate debate, which was different, was it allowed Skubic to follow up, ask questions that, you know, that he didn't think he got an answer to. It's really the only debate in the statewide races we've seen, and not that the others have been bad, but it's just the format wasn't letting that happen.
Yeah, where you had a free-flowing discussion between the two candidates, which really, I think, showed everybody's personality, the candidate's personality, and really where they are on the issues, and if they're even on how on their toes are they. And I think that debate really showed that.
Absolutely.
The governor's race. Mm-hmm. Any signs right now that the stuff about the FBI getting this referral from the Ingham County prosecutor is having any impact on the guy that you would prefer, Bill Schuette?
I haven't seen anything that's caused that. I mean, this was very, very routine matter. I mean, somebody who worked in the attorney general's office, you get these referrals all the time. This was a Democrat attorney that didn't like the way he interacted with the office, sent it to a Democrat county prosecutor. Now, that Democratic prosecutor could have acted on her own. Instead, she referred it to the FBI to get it off her plate. So I don't think this is a factor. And frankly, I think, you know, there are Democrats and others who are trying to play it up, but this is really just a routine matter. And I haven't seen it how it affected anything at all.
What happens if Nick Lyon does not get bound over into circuit court?
You know, I mean, this is one of those places where how do you fault an office that investigated the Flint water? I mean, it was the attorney general's office felt that they had to go where they had to go. And, you know, in terms of will he be bound over, you know, a lot of people make this is the most money ever spent, but it's because the state is funding both sides of it. Mm-hmm. This preliminary exam is unlike anything I think anyone's ever seen, in the sense of it's been carried out like a trial, mm-hmm. which that normally people waive it and move on. But because the state is funding the defense, it's become this, you know, overwhelming thing. I don't know what's going to happen Wednesday. I don't think it's really going to affect much that happens in this primary. I don't think Bill Schuette will ever be held. It'll ever be held against him that he tried to fight for the people of Flint. And frankly, I just don't think it's going to be that much of a factor in the race.
So let's put on your prediction hat right now. Bill Schuette defeats Brian Kelly by what to what?
I think it'll be somewhere between 15 and 20 points.
Okay.
It's been like that the whole way. He's been up 20 to 30. I think there will be some natural tightening, but I think at the end of the day, it'll be 15 to 20.
So maybe 50% for Schuette, 35% for Kelly. Colbeck might get 9 and Hines get 6, something like that.
I actually think Hines is doing better than a lot of people expect. I think he's, you know, on TV a lot more, and I think it's getting to wider audiences. So I don't know what the percentages will sort out, but I think Schuette will win by a good amount.
And then the U.S. Senate. Yeah. Contest. Penzler against James. What do you think the margin there is going to be?
I think it's going to be tight. I think James is going to win it with a tight margin. I think, you know, there's been a lot of excitement about him on the ground. You know, I think he's got a great message on TV right now, and I think he's really doing well.
And then Mike Bishop, a lot of national attention on his race. I just saw the Cook Report move that race into the toss-up category. Give me your quick thoughts on that one.
You know, I think Mike's in a good position. You know, his area of strength is Oakland County, always has been, always will. He's a lifelong resident there, represented the district there, very popular there. And, you know, it's always been a +4 district, but he's won it by 17, 18 points. I think Mike wins. I think he wins it by a good margin. And, I think Mike is fairly popular.
The next congressperson from the 11th Congressional District will be?
You know, that's a wide open one. We're doing Rocky Ruskowski's campaign. I think him and Lena are, you know, running. I think Rocky's probably a little ahead, but I think there's, you know, some competition there. And I think the Republican will wind up winning. I don't know who's going to win the general there in the Democratic side. I saw Grimal, Gupta, Saad, and Stevens are all on the air. So that's when I'm a little more out of touch with, because they all just went up. But I think the Republican will pull it out.
Stu Sandler with Grand River Strategies. Thanks for joining us on the podcast here today.
Thanks, Kyle. Take care.
That's going to do it for this week's edition of MERS Monday. Thanks to Stu for showing up, Jack, and Mike. Thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all our other podcasts. Well, guys, on a Friday afternoon, I took a trip with my friend Chad to go see Def Leppard and Journey in concert at Comerica. But before we went there, we stopped by Sri Tanadar's performance of The Blue Suitcase at the Senate Theater. It was a nice little community theater in downtown Detroit off Michigan Avenue. There was certainly some protesters outside. We had a person dressed up as a wolf in sheep's clothing. Another protester had a sign there making some reference to Marco Rubio. That was kind of cute. Inside, Sri was greeting people as they walked in the door. I would say that there was probably in the crowd maybe 45, 50 people when the show finally started, 35 minutes late. I only wanted to stay for, I thought, you know, if I could just stay for the first act, right, and I can buzz out of here so I don't miss the opening band.
Well, they could blame you for the fact that it started late then, because anytime somebody's in a hurry to do something, that's when something's going to go awry.
Yeah, no kidding. And the director came out at 25 minutes after the hour. Some heckler in the crowd yelled, "Late!" And he said, "Yeah, I know. It'll just be 10 minutes more." And I'm like, yeah, okay. It was 15 minutes more. But, you know, whatever. That's okay. This was definitely community theater. The set changes sometimes, I think, took longer than the actual scene itself. You know, I understand that there was few practices on this, and that kind of showed. But, you know, it was a nice gesture. I mean, obviously, someone was touched enough by The Blue Suitcase to do a rendition of this. And, you know, in that regard, it was very nice for Sri. You know, I couldn't help but think while I was watching some of this, Jack, that, you know, this race for Sri has really always been about Sri.
You know, anytime somebody loses any of these races, or they put in a lot of time and effort, and then they're one of the ones that doesn't make the cut, whether in the primary or ultimately in the general, you always have a little bit of, you know, the idea that there's going to be a letdown, and you kind of have a little sympathy for them. I don't think with Sri, because I think Sri has just been having a riot. He's having a good time. I don't think anybody's going to have any sympathy for him, and I don't think he wants any, because this guy is saying, look, I'm doing this, and I'm going to enjoy it, and I'm going to do it my way. You know, you got to hand it to the guy. He's making darn sure this is not some drudgery, you know, step by step toward the ballot. He's having a good time with it.
You know, it makes you also wonder, Mike, if this isn't really a success story about immigration at a time when immigration is such a touchy subject. Here's a guy who came from India several years ago now. Obviously, it's been 40 years now. But he's made a success of himself, and he's got an opportunity and a huge stage to trumpet the fact that immigrants are coming to this country and making successes of themselves and having a positive experience and overcoming adversity. And isn't that what the American dream is all about? It's kind of inspiring, really.
I think that's a good point to be made. And I think he has a lot to be proud of in the way that he has proceeded in life. I did a story earlier in the year about immigrants running for state legislature. And I think that the sense that I got from the candidates who are now citizens is that they want to tell their stories, and that they really, they're very proud of what they've accomplished. I think that's a wonderful thing. You know, we're a country of immigrants. It's something that we should pay attention to and welcome. It's great that people can come here and make a life for themselves, coming from countries that are often not happy places to be.
All right, well, we're going to close on that in the Great American Melting Pot. Till next week, I'm Kyle Moore. Take care.
Melting Pot, the Great American Melting Pot.